Now I'll call upon Brother Brian to address us to this subject, Isaiah's great prophecy of the maritime power of Tyre.
Dear Brother Roger and my beloved class members, in opening our class tonight, I thought I'd just make a few comments about a very important thing that it is to some of our areas of ecclesial life, and that is the impending election in South Africa, where we have something like about 15 ecclesias. It's a very critical week for them, my dear brothers and sisters, and this morning's headline represented something quite pertinent to that. And I thought I'd just tell you something about that. It's probably the most pertinent thing that's happening in the last week or two. There are three main groups that are vying for power in this election. There is the present government, which is the White National Party, as it's been called. At one time was mostly Afrikaner, that is, of Dutch origin people, but now in more recent years it's probably got almost an equal number of the English originated people represented in the National Party. Alright, so that's number one. And you know of President de Klerk, who has turned out to be quite a remarkable man. Now the second group is called the NAC, the National... ANC. The ANC. The African National Council. And they are headed up by Mr. Mandela. Mr. Mandela was in jail for something like 26 years, and he was released about 2 or 3 years ago, and he now has assumed the presidency of the ANC. The ANC is a very broadly based group of people. It's essentially black, and it's a political party more than dependent upon the race of the people. But it is principally of a group of people called the Xhosa. I think that's how we pronounce them. And although there are others, like Zulus and others, that are drawn into the ANC, yet the body of them came from that tribal origin. But it is broader than just a tribe. It's essentially a political party. It was very militant. It was linked with the communists until recent times. And one of the principal communists was killed, wasn't it? Does anybody remember his name? Hahn, wasn't it? Anyway, that's the ANC. And it said that they had the majority of the nation in their favour. Just by the way, there are about 5 million whites and about 25 million blacks. It might even be higher than that. The third group are the Zulus, who are headed up by Mr. Buthelezi. By Mr. Buthelezi. And he's really, for them, almost like a king, Chief Buthelezi. He's actually a very brilliant man. When I first visited South Africa, I think about 1980, people used to speak of him as the best speaker in the land. So he's an educated person, and he has a very wonderful ability to convey his thoughts to a multitude of people. Now this is essentially a tribal matter. In other words, it's the Zulu party, if you like. You wouldn't be part of Mr. Buthelezi's group unless you were a Zulu. Now, in South Africa, if you can just picture it very quickly like that, you've got this section here, which is Natal, and above them you've got Orange Free State, because they went over the Orange River, and above that you have Transvaal, because they went over the Vaal River. Transvaal. And this, the rest of it is called Cape Province. So there's four provinces. This one's Natal. And in sections of Natal, they have allocated land, you see, to the Zulu, which together they call Zwar Zulu. Zwar Zulu. So the Zulus, you see, are a very large group of people, represent millions of people, and they've been given these lands. And now this election faces them. They see themselves as losing what they thought they were going to get. That is, they really want to be their own people with their own political structure and their own tribal regulation. They don't want to lose their culture, their language. So they've been very slow in the last 6 months. Before that, they were in the negotiations. These three men, Mr. de Klerk and Mr. Mandela and Mr. Buthelezi, they were involved in the negotiations. About 6 months ago, he pulled out because he could not get that independence that he desperately wanted. You can understand that, can't you? The Zulus were the ones that the whites fought heavily against, that is, the Afrikaners, many years ago. And so did the British last century. So they now, having got this Zwar Zulu, they don't want to lose that. And what they fear, of course, is that when the election's held, Mr. Mandela will become the head of the country. He's of another tribe, and that's how Africans think. It's my tribe, it's your tribe. We fight to see who's supreme. That's just how they think. They don't think any other way than that. So you can imagine that he is very apprehensive, more than de Klerk. He is very apprehensive of what might happen to the Zulus with Mr. Mandela becomes the new Prime Minister, as is expected to be the case. In the midst of all that melee of things, my dear brothers and sisters, there's 14 ecclesias of our brethren and sisters. What it represents is something like this. If you were to imagine a group of militant Aboriginal people who were likely next week to take the reins of the government of Australia, and they were quite militant and resentful of the many years that the whites have controlled the country, how would you feel about tomorrow? It's a very real issue, isn't it? A very real issue. Everything in that country is just as built up as in Australia. The roads are as good or better. The buildings are just as great. The bridges, the whole build-up, the set-up, the commercial set-up, the foundations of the country are just as established as Australia. It's a very tense time indeed for that people. And for our brethren and sisters who are in the midst of all of that, I feel that we ought to remember them in our prayers. We don't know what the outcome will be. We do not seek to influence it humanly, and neither are they, but they are simply sitting and waiting. They will, of course, not be voting, but they will be waiting on the good hand of God to see what might come out of that very real situation for them. Who knows? It might be in a week or two's time. It could be a terrible time of absolute random chaos all through the country. As the blacks, who knows? They may sense a new sense of importance and just go on a rampage. Many of them have been bought into the ANC by promises like this. Look, Mrs. Smith, who works in one of the white homes, and she comes home with a moderate wage, which she desperately needs for her family. Look, says the ANC, you give us $25 of that per week. But I could hardly... You give us $25. How can I afford that? You give us $25 and then, therefore, we are the government. Your white master's home will be your home. See? That's what they've been promised all through the country. So for the last 5 or 10 years, they've been giving on a weekly basis to the ANC. And so that the leaders of the ANC, if you were to see their homes, they make anything in Springfield look like a chicken coop. They are enormous places of incredible wealth. That's already the leaders of the ANC. See, that's the black mentality in things like that. The leader just really carves himself a piece of superabundance. Super arrogance, like the whites have never had, but that's the mentality. How would you feel if that was your lot? I wonder if we can put ourselves in their place. Very hard sometimes, isn't it, to really do that? But that's a very real issue for our brotherhood in the next week or two. We have many brothers and sisters whom we know very well and love very much in those countries, and their very livelihood is in the balance at the moment.
Now, I understand that Brother Keith last class and the last Isaiah class gave you a very good night on the history of Tyre. An excellent night, I was told. I have to confess that I haven't had a lot of time on Isaiah 23. It's just sort of lobbed in my lap at the last minute. I might just say for our young fellows that that evidence is perhaps the virtue of your own independent Bible studies. Because years ago, when I was doing the readings for a couple of nights, I put time into Isaiah chapter 23 and just worked away at the chapter until I had marked up most of it. And you see, whoever would have known that... what's the date today? That Wednesday the 20th might come along and I'd have to lead a class on Isaiah chapter 23. See, that's the wisdom of putting every bit of time you've got into your Bibles and working on the odd chapters here and there that you might just get interested in. Work on it. Make a study of it for a couple of nights. Mark it up in your margin. And it's there as a perpetual chapter of usefulness. I feel that very much tonight, I can assure you, because without that, I wouldn't have been able to be here. All right, chapter 23, as we've said in our heading, is about the great maritime power of Tyre. And Brother Keith has filled you in, essentially, with what was involved in that. As far as the date of the prophecy is concerned, I would put it in the reign of Hezekiah. I can't see any reason why it should not. The previous chapter, chapter 22, is found in the reign of Hezekiah, and there's very good reasons for seeing that chapters 24 to 26 and chapter 28 indeed were also in the reign of Hezekiah, the fourth king in which Isaiah was prophesying. Do you remember there were four kings in the prophecy of Isaiah? Chapter 1, verse 1, just for the many young ones, it's lovely to see our young ones here too, in school holidays in particular, but in other times too. It's been lovely to see the consistent attendance of our young ones, both baptised and unbaptised, at our class. But particularly tonight, I suppose the release from schoolwork does help in that regard, doesn't it? But in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of four kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz and Hezekiah." Uzziah's chapters, I believe, are chapters 1 to 5. Jotham's chapter 6, Ahaz's chapters 7 to 12, and from thence on, I think it is essentially in the times of Hezekiah. So, Isaiah chapter 23, therefore, is set in the times of Hezekiah. And it's a very interesting thing. If in your mind you can contemplate, you can get the overall picture. We're well before Babylon, aren't we, in the time of Hezekiah, 100 years before. And yet 100 years before, obviously, Tyre was a very great power, a very rich and influential power, at least 100 years before Babylon came on the scene. And the historians record that that's exactly true. The influence and supremacy of Tyre upon the waves went for hundreds of years before that time. Did Brother Keith mention to you what the name Tyre means?
Am I to take from your silence that he did? Good.
Why do we have to rely on our sisters to come up with those gems of knowledge, eh? Thanks, Ruth. T, boy, I'm really good tonight. T-Y-R-E is very similar to a Hebrew word meaning rock. What is it? Do you think that's similar? Well, I'm telling you it is. Well, it is very similar, actually. There are similar vowels there, and that's the essential derivation of the word, meaning a rock. And yet, originally, it wasn't on that sort of island as a rock by itself, was it? It must have been that it was perched so distinctly on the coast and was so built up and fortified that it took this title of the rock, the 26th chapter of Isaiah. The 26th chapter in verse 4 speaks of a greater rock. A rock of ages. We're going to learn tonight of the eclipse of the rock of Tyre. But in chapter 26 and verse 4, we have the everlasting rock. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in Yahweh is everlasting strength. The margin indicates correctly that the Hebrew is the rock of ages. It's there during the reign of Tyre. It's there in the time of Babylon. It's there through all of Israel's history. It's still there, the eternal and unchanging God of Israel. So whilst they called themselves the rock, it was to see decline. Now the origins of this people we find in Genesis chapter 10. Would you like to come through to Genesis chapter 10? I know Keith must have passed through this way, did he not? We have in verse 2, among the sons of Noah, we have Japheth. And in verse 4, we have the sons of Javan. Javan was one of the sons of Japheth, verse 2. And the sons of Javan were Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. Now make a little note there that Kittim is the name of Cyprus, where Cyprus gets its name from. So that Cyprus is, in Isaiah chapter 23 and verse 1, referred to by the name of Kittim. In Genesis 10 verse 4 it's got a K, and in Isaiah 23 and verse 1 it has a CH. So that's just unfortunate, but it doesn't change the sense at all. It's Kittim, right? So that shows, doesn't it, that the origins of these peoples, it goes right back here to Genesis chapter 10, as we would expect. So there's where Tarshish comes from Japheth. Now Sidon, which was the twin city to Tyre, that comes from the sons of Ham. Sidon is found in verse 19. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gerar unto Gezer, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboam, even unto Lashar. So Sidon is from a different branch of the family of Noah. He's from the children of Ham. And it's interesting there in verse 19 that it's related to Canaan right from the beginning. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon. Now, I say that's interesting because Canaan means merchant. You know, you hear the Canaanites. What it means is that they were traders, merchant people, traffickers in the old sense. All right? That's what Canaan means. So we will find in Isaiah chapter 23 that we have the word used in its primary sense, and it says in the Hebrew it's the word Canaan. But it hasn't got a capital C, so to speak, because it's being used in its more basic sense. But it's very interesting in verse 19 that the border of the Canaanites, of the traffickers, of the merchants, was from Sidon. And Sidon and Tyre stood as two cities who always had that significance of being the merchants, the people involved in trade. Now, Sidon was a twin city, as I said, to Tyre. And if you turn up your maps at the back of your Bible, you'll see the relationship of these two cities. Did you do much of this last time? Excuse me asking that question from time to time, but I don't want to bore people. On the other hand, I want to make sure that we've got all the background we need. I can't tell you which plate it is because yours are different to mine now. I've got the old version Bible. But can you see the area denoted as Phoenicia along the coast above Mount Carmel? Mount Carmel is a very significant pointer into the sea. If you run up that coast, you'll find there is another little pimple, as it were, on the coast, and that's called Tyre. 35 miles further north, you come to Sidon. 35 miles further north, you come to Sidon, which I believe is 5 miles south of a river called Leontes. In fact, you can see the river there, and that river is called the Leontes River. So that's Tyre and Sidon, and they were two great merchant cities together. They dominated the trading upon the seas for hundreds of years together. Now, originally, Sidon, which is mentioned, of course, in our Isaiah 23 as well, Sidon was the greater of the cities. If you turn to Joshua chapter 11, I'm going right back to Joshua now. You know, we're turning over 500 years, 600 years. Joshua chapter 11. And verse 8. And Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them and chased them unto great Zidon, and unto Misrephoth-maim, and unto the valley of Mizpah eastward, and they smote them until they left none remaining. Great Zidon, see? Like you speak of a city as being great, or a person as being great. Constantine the Great, see? Zidon the Great was known as the great city. At this stage, Tyre was not mentioned, but Sidon obviously was already a great city. Same thing in chapter 19. Chapter 19 and verse 28. And Hebron and Rehob and Hammon and Canaan, even unto great Sidon. And the Sidonians, that you've heard as one of the peoples of the land, got their name from that city. That city perhaps was named after them, or they got their name from that city. But they began to spread up and down that area. So the peoples, later called Phoenicians, who inhabited that stretch of the coast of Palestine were called Sidonians. Like down further, you had a coastal people who were called the Philistines. Up in the north, they were called the Sidonians. And they had their name from that part. So we have an early reference to them. Where's the early reference to them? Do you remember? When Israel was establishing themselves in the land? Book of Judges, isn't it? In Judges chapter 3, in verse 3. Verses 1 to 4. Would you like to read that for us, please? Peter, our new brother Peter.
Now these are the nations which the Lord led through Israel upon, even as many of Israel as they have not done for the war of the Canaan. Only the generations of the children of Israel might know peace and war, at least such as before knew nothing thereof. Namely, five rulers of the Philistines, and all the Canaanites, and the Sidonians, and the Hivites, that dwelt from Mount Lebanon. And they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they were hearkened unto the commandments of the Lord, which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses.
These people wish to dwell peaceably, and in that is evidenced the kind of people the Sidonians were. They knew how to make terms. They knew how to negotiate with people. They knew how to get their way and continue on, you see. They were not confrontive in their policies. That's what the Sidonians were. And in that, you see, they were really more dangerous than somebody that might attack Israel straight on. Israel would know their enemy. But a person who came and wished to do trade and to make terms that were equally beneficial to both Israel and themselves, that was a power that was going to be around a lot longer and be, in the end, a more subtle enemy to Israel than those who confronted them. And so they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of Yahweh. And that proved to be exactly the type of people that they were. So there in verse 3, again, they're linked, aren't they, immediately with the Canaanites and the Sidonians, who it tells us in chapter 18 and verse 7, were quiet and secure. Quiet and secure. Now, it's an interesting thing that that same coast is inhabited by what country today? What's the country that occupies that piece of country today? Lebanon, yes. And of all the peoples of the East, apart from the return of the Jewish people in recent years, there's nobody that has been a trader like the Lebanese people. Do you know any Lebanese people in Adelaide? You do? Have they got shops, John? Pardon? Shahadi Brothers. I'm sorry, I don't know what that is, but dry cleaners, right? Yeah. Well, I've got quite a few Lebanese clients, and inevitably they're traders. That's what they are. They're all shopkeepers. I understand a big percentage of the fish and chip people are Lebanese, and they're traders, you see. Restaurateurs and things like that. And that's just come right through that race and is an evidence of what this chapter is talking about. The Lebanese have learnt that same traditional understanding that has been part and parcel of the Canaanites, the merchantmen. And so that way of life has continued all through those hundreds of years. And for many years, the oil money of Saudi Arabia or of the Muscat and Oman or other countries, Iraq and Iran and so on, they would focus their oil money through Lebanon, so that Beirut, which was the capital of Lebanon, was therefore very wealthy. It was the banking centre of the Arabs. Isn't that interesting? And historical connection with this old sense of trafficking. Always the man in the middle, who was therefore able, despite what fluctuations might come from one way or the other, they were able to trade their way out because they had so many irons in the fire. And they developed a worldwide trading system so that if there was trouble here, they could still trade here. And if there was a glut of things there, then they could take them to here and so on. And having that tremendously fluctuant command of the sea, they were therefore able to preserve their identity when other nations were more limited, less flexible than was Tyre. They became exceedingly rich. As I was saying before, they're the man in the middle, and if he has to buy his goods more expensively here than those who he sells to, they, of course, are the ones that bear that burden. The man in the middle never bears that, does he? It's the men on the ends that bear the burden. He passes on the extra burden to the customer. It's as true today as it ever was. Well, it was true, of course, in all the years of Tyre. She was able, never mind what fluctuations in her commercial prices she had to experience, she was able always to pass that on to the customer. And so she was very, very rich, always able to obtain her own slice of the pie. Give you a case in point of how wealthy she was. When Shalmaneser V, one of the Assyrian kings, when he placed a tribute upon the kingdom of the north, the kingdom of Israel, it was a tribute of 10 talents of gold upon Hoshea, who was the last king of the northern tribe. But upon Phoenicia, just that maritime strip of land, he placed a tribute of 150 talents of gold. That's 15 times the tribute that was placed on the whole nation of the northern kingdom. This tiny little strip had 15 times exacted out of it, as did the northern kingdom. So they're exceedingly rich because of this colossal trading that went on. All right. Now we come to Isaiah chapter 23 with just that little bit of background and work our way through these very interesting verses. The burden of Tyre, how ye ships of Tarshish, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste. not Tarshish, but Tyre. It's a burden of Tyre. It is laid waste so that there is no house, no entering in from the land of Kittim. It is revealed to them. Now, the mention of Tarshish is several times through this chapter. See verse 6, pass ye over to Tarshish. What's Tarshish got to do with Tyre? Again, verse 10, pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength. Verse 14, how ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. Now I want to drum that home right from the start. There is an immediate association of Tyre and Tarshish. They obviously were very closely related in a maritime trading association. So that whilst Tyre will become the centre and fulcrum of that, yet there are ships of Tarshish who are working in with that system. Now, where was Tarshish? Well, that's what many historians have tried to determine. But one thing we can say is that Tarshish had two basic wings. There was an eastern Tarshish and there was a western Tarshish. How can we determine that? Do you remember? How do we know there was a western one, for example? A prophet took a ship, didn't he? Jonah. Let's have a look at that quickly. When he was told that he should go to Nineveh, verse 2, who was a bitter enemy of Israel, and that he should cry against it for its wickedness, Jonah was grieved to think that Nineveh could receive a gospel of repentance. Jonah rose up, verse 3, to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of Yahweh and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. Now, there was no Suez Canal in those days, so it was going to Tarshish, and it was on the western side in the seaport of Joppa, a little seaport indeed. If it was there, then Tarshish must have been west of the coast of Palestine and went down into it to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of Yahweh. So obviously it was a long way west of the coast of Palestine. All right, so there was a western Tarshish. But how do we know there was also an eastern Tarshish? Have any of you heard of Good King Jehoshaphat? Good King Jehoshaphat? What about a study weekend? Learn something about Jehoshaphat. In the Second Chronicles chapter 20. This is something we'll be looking at our camp, isn't it? In the reign of Jehoshaphat, he sought to make an alliance with the ships of Tarshish. And after this, did Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, join himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, who did very wickedly. He joined himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish. To go to Tarshish. All right, and they made the ships in Ezion Geba. Now, keeping your hand there, go back to your maps again at the back of your Bible. Where's Ezion Geba? It's in looking at the map that it makes this point very powerful to us, very clear to us. Where's Ezion Geba? Can you see the little tongue of the Red Sea coming up? As you go past the Sinai Peninsula on your map, and when it gets to the top, there are two little port cities. One's called Elat, and the other's called Ezion Geba. Can you see that? Everybody see that? Elat and Ezion Geba. Can you see that? Anybody having trouble? Just ask your intelligent neighbour. Lydia might be next year. So there you've got the two little port cities at the bottom of Israel. Now one of those does today service for Jordan, and it's called Aqaba, and you can see that Aqaba is like Ezion Geber. Is anybody having still trouble finding those? Do help someone if they are. Because it doesn't make much sense unless you can see the picture. All right. Everybody got it? Right. So Eilat and Ezion Geber, they were two port cities at the top of the tongue of the Red Sea. Now today one of those is a port for the country of Jordan, and it's called Aqaba, which you can see is from Ezion Geber. The name is from that, Aqaba. And Eilat is the name of the other, and that's the southern port for Israel. Got the same name basically today. Right? So that's where the ships were bought, where they were built. If they were built there, then that means that those ships were going down that tongue of Red Sea, and they were going out east to go to Tarshish. It says in verse 36, he joined himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish, and they made the ships in Ezion Geber, or Geber. Then Eliezer the son of Dodava of Marishah prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because thou hast joined thyself with Ahaziah, Yahweh hath broken thy works. And the ships were broken, that they were not able to go to Tarshish. Now get that very clear. There was Jonah going out to the west to Tarshish. Here is the ships of Jehoshaphat and Ahaziah going out east to Tarshish. So obviously there were two wings known as Tarshish. And so I don't think it's speaking necessarily of a place, but of a system of ships that were obviously related to the interests of Tyre. Tyre obviously had her own ships as well, but they were great associates with those of Tarshish. And hence, of course, the famous reference that we have in Ezekiel chapter 38, which you know so well. And I want to have a quick look at it just now, because we've got to keep it in mind as we're running down through this chapter. Ezekiel in his 38th chapter, and how we know this, eh? In Ezekiel in his 38th chapter, in verse 13, has a reference to these merchants of Tarshish in a chapter in the latter days. So there's got to be another chapter in the fulfillment of Tarshish. Not something just in the old days of Tyre, but something it will be updated to the latter days. So verse 13, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? But it seems to be more words than action, doesn't it? But nevertheless, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, see that clearly, because that's saying whatever you've learnt about Tarshish in the old days, there's going to be a rerun of that in the latter days. And that's important to our understanding. So we come back to Isaiah chapter 23. And we notice this relationship with Tarshish. In fact, before we get to Isaiah again, I'll come by Ezekiel chapter 27. If you've got a piece of paper there, here's other prophecies relating to Tyre. A list of them, right? Put Isaiah 23. Number 2, Jeremiah 25, verse 22. Number 3, Amos 1, verse 9 to 10. Number 4, Ezekiel 26 to 28. How many chapters is that? Three whole chapters on the prophecy of Tyre. Three whole chapters in the prophecy of Ezekiel. That's quite remarkable, isn't it? Number 5, Joel chapter 3, verse 4 to 8. Number 6, Zechariah 9, verse 2 to 4. And Psalm 45 and verse 12. So there's seven other passages. So we turn to that lengthy one in Ezekiel. And I want you to notice this. Ezekiel chapter 27. You'll see that the little heading at the beginning of the chapter says, "The riches and irrecoverable fall of Tyre." And when you look through at those whom she is trading with, you cannot help notice again this association with Tarshish. Verse 12, "Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches, with silver, iron, tin and lead. They traded in thy fairs." Tarshish is also mentioned in verse 25. "The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the seas." So, Isaiah 23, a relationship immediately in the chapter between Tyre and Tarshish. Ezekiel chapter 27, in giving a coverage of those different nations that would do merchandise with Tyre, gives accent to the work of Tarshish. Tarshish in verse 12, Tarshish again at the end in verse 25. So it was obviously the first companion in trade to that of Tyre. Now, returning then to Isaiah chapter 23, it says, in a very interesting little expression, "It is laid waste so that there is no house or haven." No haven to enter, because that's the term we use of a returning vessel, isn't it? As it seeks some port of quiet. No haven to enter. "From the land of Kittim, it is revealed to them." Or it is unveiled to them. Now the land of Kittim, of course, is Cyprus. So if again you turn back to your map at the back of your Bible, you get the little picture of a returning vessel. We have the Sea of the Mediterranean. We have the ships of Tarshish. And they're coming back from their very far western travels. We believe that they had been, in fact, founded in Britain, at least certain stages of their history. And so as they're returning to Tyre, can you see Tyre on the coast? They come by Cyprus. And Cyprus is just a little bit north and some west as well from the city of Tyre. So on their travels they call in to Cyprus and do trade in Cyprus, or Kittim, as it is revealed in Isaiah chapter 23. And so it says that as they're coming towards Tyre, they're told the message. What message? They're told the message that there is no safe haven in Tyre. Tyre has been destroyed. "How, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, is Tyre, so that there is no haven to enter. From the land of Cyprus, it is revealed to the ships of Tarshish as they're returning home." Quite colourful, isn't it, the way it is described. So verse 2, "Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle," or the coast, as the word means. And those countries that had their, that were west of Israel, were generally referred to as the coastlands or the isles. Not all of them, of course, were islands. And so the word isle here really means coastlands. So in all those spots where the ships of Tarshish would call in on behalf of Tyre, "Be still, ye inhabitants of the coastland, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished," or have refilled. And it's like, the sense of a trader. My father was a grocer, and I would remember the traders coming to the store, and they would ask you, "See, how much of this you had in store?" And you'd say, "Oh, look, I've got, 25 pound of butter left." "Well, then perhaps you'll need, Lewis, you'll need another box of 52 pound of butter in a box," wasn't it? Do you remember that? 52 pound. I don't know why it was 52, but that's always what it was, wasn't it? So you get one box or two boxes, depending on how much was in store. So here you've got that same sense. "That pass over the sea have replenished you." They have refilled you, you see. They were trading, therefore seeing how much they'd sold and providing them with the extra that they would need. So you see, they were right across the seas, affecting all peoples. Verse 3, and by great waters, the seed or grain of Sihor, the harvest of the Nile, as the RSV puts it. The harvest of the Nile was her increase. So there in verse 3 it's saying that in particular this power was so often involved in the shifting of wheat from Egypt. Sihor means Egypt, or it was in Egypt. If you hold your hand there, and John, if you'd like to look up 1 Chronicles 13 verse 5 and read that in just a moment. And Royce, if you would look up Jeremiah 2 verse 18 and read that one in just a moment. And the rest of us can look up whichever one you like. 1 Chronicles 13 verse 5 or Jeremiah 2 verse 18. John, would you like to read 1 Chronicles 13 verse 5? References to Sihor. So that would be denoting something way, way down the south in Sihor. And Royce, Jeremiah 2:18, thanks.
And now, what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt to drink the waters of Sihor? Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river?
Right. So there again we have the references to the area of Sihor. The end of that verse 3 it says... just another couple of evidences of that trade. Can you think of another evidence of that trade of wheat from Egypt being shipped around in the Bible? Have a look quickly in Acts chapter 27. In Acts 27 and verse 6, when Paul is... on his way to Rome as a prisoner to stand before Augustus, it says in Acts 27 and verse 6, and not Augustus rather, but to stand before Caesar, there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria. Alexandria is a big port city on the coast of Egypt. A ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. In Acts chapter 28 and verse 11, after 3 months we departed in a ship of Alexandria, which had wintered in the isle, whose sign was Castor and Pollux. So they've got the same thing going on, now supplying it to Italy or to Rome, because that's where the centres of habitation were. But interesting, isn't it, that Egypt should have been considered a place for the export of grain, not Australia or America or Canada like it is in our world, but Egypt. In fact, we would never think to be importing grain from Egypt. Thanks, Jace, read that for us, pal. Thank you very much. Good. That's a good reference. Now, chapter 23, again then, at the end of that, it has an expression, and she is a mart of nations. Now, here again, Ezekiel uses the same term. In Ezekiel chapter 27, you might put a little marker in those chapters in Ezekiel, 26 to 28, because we keep on going back there. In chapter 27 of Ezekiel, and verse 3, and say unto Tyrus, O thou that art situate at the entry of the sea. That's colourful, isn't it? The sea doesn't really have one point of entry, does it? But what it means is this, that if you want to trade out on that sea, if you want to trade with the nations of the earth at that time, you had to do a deal with Tyre. It had the whole thing in its hands. It had the strings all tied up. And you know, trading powers do exactly that. Because they become powerful, they can prevent others trading with other competitors. because they say that we will break you if you don't trade with us. Do you realise that? That's what happens in trade. I remember, for example, when, as an example that's closer to home, do you remember when Brother Mansfield was trading in salmon? There was no salmon coming into Australia at one stage except it came through him, because they wouldn't do it, because he would be able to bring so much salmon on and compete with their product, you see. That was Brother Jim Mansfield in Sydney. But just gives you an idea of the power of a trading power. And therefore, verse 3, say unto Tyrus, O thou that art situated at the entry of the sea, a colourful expression, saying that if you're going to enter the trade of the sea, you've got to go through that power, which art a merchant of the people for many isles. Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, O Tyrus, thou hast said, I am a perfect beauty. So there we've got the same expression. We have traders within a country. Tyre was a trader within countries, among countries, and so had a very special role. Coming back now to Isaiah 23 and verse 4, he says, be thou ashamed, O Zidon. That's the city that was 35 miles further up the coast. It says, for the sea hath spoken, even the strength of the sea, the fortress of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. That is to say, her future has been eclipsed. Here was Zidon bemoaning the fact that Tyre has been taken. See, when the great centre of trade is affected, those who were dependent upon her greatly grieve when they see what has in fact happened. And so in this colourful language, the prophet says, the sea hath spoken. And what is the sea saying? The sea saying, there's no profit in the sea. There's no future in the sea. That is in the trafficking upon the sea. I travail not. I've got no progeny coming forth, nor bring forth children. Neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. I have no future. Zidon sees that the sea upon which it depended, being situated there on the Palestine coast, has got no future. In Ezekiel chapter 27 again, we see the interdependence of these powers, one upon another. Those nations therefore cared and fostered Tyre because their own interests were involved in hers. So in Ezekiel chapter 27, just verses say three down to 11, thy borders, it says, verse 4, are in the midst of the seas. Thy builders have perfected thy beauty. They have made all thy ships boards of fir trees of Sina. They have taken cedars from Lebanon to make masts for thee. Of the oaks of Bashan, that's further in, behind the river Jordan, of the oaks of Bashan have they made thine oars. The company of the Asherites, that's up in the area of Assyria, have made thy benches of ivory, brought out of the isles of Kittim, ivory from the island of Cyprus, fine linen with broidered work from Egypt in the south, was that which thou spreadest forth to thy sail. Blue and purple from the isles of Elisha was that which covered thee. The inhabitants of Zidon and Arvad were thy mariners. Thy wise men, O Tyrus, that were in thee were thy pilots. In other words, its knowledge was not in mathematics, it was not in language. Its knowledge was in the seas. Its skilled people were dedicated to the knowledge of the seas, like no other people. And they had, of course, gathered much information through the years, which was in their catalogues, and taught to their young men, who in turn became the pilots of their vessels. And the inhabitants of Zidon were also skillful in that, and those of Arvad, and so they helped in the piloting of the vessels through the different oceans. The ancients of Gebel and the wise men thereof were in thee, thy caulkers. All the ships of the sea with their mariners were in thee to occupy thy merchandise. And so you've got all of those nations in their different ways cooperating to the glory of Tyre, because it was mutually profitable to do so. Verse 5, and at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. Now, the report of Egypt being taken is given in Isaiah 20th chapter. In the 20th chapter and verse 5, the collapse of Egypt was going to be a very grievous matter to some. In Isaiah chapter 20 and verse 5 we read, they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory. And the inhabitant of this island, or this shore, this coastland, same word, shall say in that day, behold, such is our expectation. Whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And how shall we escape? You see, they put hope and trust in Egypt, but it's turned out to be a false hope. So, as at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. The collapse of Tyre was going to mean a terrible amount to them. Now in verse 6 we have Tarshish in particular, who is very grievously concerned, verses 6 and 7, because of the news of Tarshish. Tarshish, because of the news of Tyre. Tarshish weeps at the news. Pass ye over to Tarshish. How does Tarshish take the news of the collapse of Tyre? How, ye inhabitants of the isle or coast. There was great fear and consternation among those of Tarshish at the fall of this great city. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? It had a rich and wonderful history. Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn or to dwell. So if we keep our hand there and come again to Ezekiel, we will see how true those matters were. The nations grieved the fact that this trading power, which of course took a profit out of them, but on the other hand also provided them with profit and trade. So in Ezekiel 26, this time verse 15, we see of the grief that was felt by the other nations when Tyre collapsed. Thus saith the Lord Yahweh to Tyrus, shall not the isles shake at the sound of thy fall? When the wounded cry, when the slaughter is made in the midst of thee, then all the princes of the sea shall come down from their thrones and lay away their robes and put off their broidered garments. They shall clothe themselves with trembling. They shall sit upon the ground and shall tremble at every moment and be astonished at thee. And they shall take a lamentation for thee and say to thee, how art thou destroyed that wast inhabited of seafaring men? The renowned city, as it says here, is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days, your renowned city, which was strong in the sea, she and her inhabitants, which caused their terror to be on all that haunt it. Now shall the isles tremble in the day of thy fall, yea, the isles that are in the sea shall be troubled at thy departure. We would have something like the same thing today, for example, if Wall Street, the share market of America, if that sort of collapsed like it did in 1987, wasn't it? In October 1987. And there's tremendous ramifications all around the world, wasn't it? As the trade of people suddenly stopped or looked to be hesitant. Well, that's a very similar thing. Wall Street, or Tyre, was the supporting wall of the commerce of the world at that time. And so in this colourful and remarkable language, Ezekiel describes the portents of heart of these people when it came about. In Ezekiel chapter 27 and verse 25, you know how Isaiah said, is this your joyous city? This your joyous city, the city that they sang about. And in Ezekiel 27 and verse 25 it says, that's just what they did. The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the seas. See, they were traders together and reliant upon each other. Now we come to verses 8 to 12. verses 8 to 12 of Isaiah 23. And the heading for that is, "It is Yahweh who has determined this." It is Yahweh who hath determined this. As it says in verse 9, "Yahweh of hosts hath purposed it to stain the pride of all glory, and to bring it into contempt all the honourable of the earth." So in verse 8 it poses the question, who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes? You know, there's usually a difference, isn't there, between a rich man, a merchant, a trader, and a prince. But here these men have been so long established and are so powerful and wealthy that their merchants have become princes. There's an atmosphere of royalty in every one of their homes. See the idea? Whose traffickers are the honourable of the earth. Great names are found in the traffickers. And that word traffickers is the word for Canaanites. It's exactly the same word in the Hebrew, because that's what Canaan means, to traffic. Alright, so there's the question. Who hath taken this counsel? Who's brought this against this crowning city? How could such a thing happen? The collapse of world trade. Whoever has done this? What cunning plot has been determined against this, the centre of all trade? Verse 9 provides that answer. Yahweh of hosts, a militant title of God, hath purposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honourable of the earth. And so it speaks in verses 10 to 11 then of the declining strength of Tyre and Tarshish. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength, or as it means, a girdle. There's nothing to hold together. Everything can sort of flap open. There is no binding together again. There is no restraint. And so Tarshish is seen like a floodwater that just passes through the land without purpose and rushes to the sea, to the end of the land. Its people have lost their strength. They have lost their girding. And so as the water would pass down through the land, without purpose, without intent, and causing ravaging concern, so those people of Tarshish are in that time. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more girdle, no more strength. He stretched out his hand over the sea. Who did? He shook the kingdom. Who did? Yahweh hath given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. Alright, so there in that section we have the answer given, that it has not happened because of some collusion of other powers. And you know, you sometimes wonder, don't you, what does create a collapse in the economic market? Is it some collusion of influential people that bring it about? Well, there's the ultimate answer, isn't it? Who did this? There it is. Who caused that in 1987? And the world tried to think, whatever happened? Why did it happen? And some said, well, because the computers were fixed in such that, when they came to a certain price, they'd immediately start selling and selling and selling, so it created a spiral. But is that the answer? See, God was behind that, surely. Seeing the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear. That's his description. It is. You know, Australia seems to be climbing out of recession by a couple of inches, and the next minute it's sort of tumbling back again, isn't it? Isn't that the atmosphere of today? Nothing's certain anymore. Nothing will be, my dear brothers and sisters. I'm sure of that. Because Yahweh of hosts hath determined that the sea and the waves would roar without restraint. The rivers would pass through the land, devouring and scouring without intent or purpose. So verse 12, "And he said, Thou shalt no more rejoice, O thou oppressed virgin daughter of Zidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus or Kittim. There also shalt thou have no rest." So they escape from the coast of Sidon, 35 miles up the coast from Tyre. And they go to Cyprus across the sea, thinking that it will be better there. But in fact, it's no different at all. there also shalt thou have no rest. There is no haven of relief. Now, verse 13 is an enigmatic verse as far as the Hebrew is concerned and has all kinds of translations. I'm not quite sure in my own mind just what it means, but I'm going to give you what I think the sense of it is. Verse 12 presents the thought that there might be escape in Cyprus. Verse 13 introduces another power. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans. Could it not be the suggestion that as they thought to go to Cyprus, which was on the west, so also they might think to go to Chaldea, which was on the east? And it would be in place because the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, and the men of Tyre had a league. They used to be in association with each other together. Obviously they would be because this was a growing power. And that increasingly became so as Babylon got stronger. So it'd be natural for the men of Tyre to think, well, look, we'll go to Babylon when trouble came upon them, when they were invaded. Verse 13 seems to pour cold water, as it were, upon that idea. That's how I see verse 13 anyway. So it goes like this. Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not, that is the Chaldeans, in whom you now put your trust. This people was not till the Assyrian founded it for them. And he didn't found it for you. He founded that city for them that dwell in the desert. So Babylon was put there as a great city founded thereby by the Assyrians, people from the north. And it wasn't put there for you, Tyre or Sidon, for you who were escaping from the coast of Phoenicia. It was put there for people in the desert. It was never made for you. That's how I see the sense of it. And therefore you won't find the rest and respite that you think you might in that city. And you see, it also opens up the fact, verse 13, that when Isaiah gave this prophecy, the powers that were to come upon them first were going to be the Assyrians. Later on we know, of course, of the Babylonians who came in Nebuchadnezzar's time. And he spent 13 years at the walls of Tyre. Then later we know, of course, how that Alexander the Great came against Tyre. And the Tyrians had then gone, of course, into the island that was just off the coast. So, but the first that came were these, the Assyrians. And so it's interesting, verse 13, that Assyria is seen as the people that put up the kingdom of Babylon. So don't put your trust in the Chaldeans. They were, in fact, founded by the Assyrian powers. So, verse 13, you can have a little talk about that later, but that's how I think it might be read. So verse 14, how ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. All mourn, but Tarshish bemoans even louder than the other nations. Now in verses 15 to 18, we have a very interesting little section of prophecy. It forecasts a period of 70 years, verse 15, in which there will be almost nothing heard of Tyre. It shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. That is, it would return to its earlier exercise of trade. But it would be eclipsed before that time for 70 years, according to the days of one king. Now it's very difficult, despite the specific nature of those details, to provide an interpretation of exactly what that means. Some have tried to link it up with the 70 years in which Israel would be in Babylon, but that doesn't really fit, does it? When Israel was in Babylon, it was the time of Babylon's ascendancy. And it wasn't necessarily the 70 years of the eclipse of the power of Tyre. As Babylon was growing, it had an increasing relationship with Tyre. And then, as I said, Nebuchadnezzar had 13 years in which he lay siege to Tyre. So if he was doing that for 13 years and that kingdom of Babylon was at its zenith for 70 years, then it was at least 13 years before that the rest of that period developed. But perhaps it was after that 13 years that Tyre was put in a state of rest or quiet. But you know, Nebuchadnezzar never actually took the city. Because of the prophecy in Ezekiel which says, give Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar because he laboured all these years against Tyre, and in the end he never got what he wanted. So give him in the place of Tyre, give him Egypt, says God. So that can't altogether fulfil the terms of the prophecy. Certainly Sennacherib did take Tyre. He certainly took Sidon. And we know that the king that came after him, whose name I think was Assurbanipal, he did take both Tyre and Sidon. As a matter of fact, he went from the coast and he went to Cyprus to there also take Cyprus. So that would work in, perhaps better than any of the others. But then that there were 70 years of eclipse is not really easy from the time of Assurbanipal to determine that there were 70 years when Tyre was forgotten. After that time is very hard to determine. However, let's press on. Verse 16 says that after that eclipse, Tyre will sing as a harlot. That is to say, she'd be out and about like a harlot would be, prepared to do a deal with anyone who came along. Wherever there was money, wherever there was a deal, wherever there was an opportunity for a dollar, she was there. Take a harp, go about the city, thou harlot that hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, attract your customers, that mayest be remembered. And it would be a successful return to commercialism. It shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that Yahweh will visit Tyre. And she shall turn her hire, return to her hire, says the RSV, return to her hire. That is, to all of that commerce that she'd been before involved in. And shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth, exactly like she had before. So Tyre was going to have a period of eclipse for 70 years and then to return with great activity again as the mart of all nations. As we have that term in verse 3, the mart of nations. Mart means market. It's just a shortened version of market. The mart of nations, the central focus of world trade. And she would return to that as verse 17 says. And her merchandise, then verse 18 we read, very intriguingly, her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to Yahweh. It shall not be treasured nor laid up. That is, it won't be stored or accumulated for human purposes. It'll be for a functional benefit to the people of God. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before Yahweh, the saints, Israel in the first instance, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing, for stately attire, as others translate it, to eat with satisfaction. In other words, good clothes and good food. And Tyre would be put to use to bring those necessary things to the people of God. There's a little reference in Proverbs which speaks about food coming from afar. Can you remember that? Quaint little reference. Good. What's it say, Glenn? She bringeth. Yeah, that's right. Proverbs 31. Mark, would you like to read that for us? I've got to get the right Mark tonight because the other one's on holiday. Yeah, Proverbs 31 verse 14, Mark. Yes. That would be food that would have come from the ships of Tarshish trading on the coast, see? Or sent down the coast from Tyre, which is not very far north of the land of Israel. And so, unlike our big shopping centres, our big food marts today, we can go in there and you get anything from Czechoslovakian jelly to Iceland tea or whatever. Whatever you want, it's all there, isn't it? The whole place comes from all around the world, not in those days. It was this power that was able to provide that. And so if you're trying to make a nice little meal and have something a bit special, then you might have to get it from the merchant, and that would come from the Sidonians, from the men of Tyre and their collaborators in trade. Now in verse 18 it's saying that they're going to be doing that for the purpose of God's people, not for their own accumulation, but they're going to be doing it for valuable purposes for them that dwell before Yahweh. Now, of the greater application, have a look in chapter 60. Chapter 60 and verse 9. To give the full import of this greater application, we would have to take another night. But you know how that in Ezekiel 38 we speak of the ships of Tarshish as representative of England, who has had a very wide expanse across the nations. The sun never sets upon the British Empire, they said. When we were in Wales, they told us the reason that the sun never sets upon the British Empire was because God couldn't trust the English in the dark. Some people see that as very funny. But it never set, you see. It was Britain in the east, it was Britain in the west. In fact, she was the one that opened up, wasn't she, the Suez Canal, and bought those shares of the Suez market, of the Suez Canal Company. So she was in the east with her East India Company, and she, of course, was in the west. And I'm sure that it's that power which is going to mirror these things in the future and do so for the good of God's people that dwell with him.